This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.
Welcome to a recap of our latest Third Thursday webinar. Hear directly from expert panelists as they discuss Parkinson's research and answer your questions about living with the disease. Join us live next time by registering for an upcoming webinar at michaeljfox.org.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. I'm Larry Gifford, and I will be your moderator today. I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2017 at the age of 45. I sit on the Michael J. Fox Foundation's Patient Council, and I host the podcast When Life Gives You Parkinson's, which you can find linked in the resource list on your screen. So today we're going to discuss a few things: how Parkinson's can impact your sex life, sexual changes women can experience, sexual changes men can experience, how medications can impact sex drive, how to treat sexual dysfunction with Parkinson's. So let's meet our panelists for today's discussion. With me today is Dr. Camille Vaughn, an associate professor and section chief of geriatrics and gerontology at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. Thank you for being here, Dr. Vaughn.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
And Dr. Daniela Whitman is an associate professor of urology at the University of Michigan and a certified sex therapist. We're glad you're with us too, Dr. Whitman.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, I want to start with something that may make us all just take a deep breath and relax. we are all in this sexual adventure together. The headline of this slide alone makes me feel better about myself. Sexual challenges are common with people with Parkinson's. Whew! I'm not an oddball. Some studies suggest as many as 70 to 80% of people with PD experience some aspects of sexual dysfunction. Does that line up with your experience, Camille?
Yes, we actually often have people bring this up to our attention if we've kind of created the environment to make it easy to talk about. And a lot of people do report complaints, and there are often things that we can do to help.
There was a Fox Insight study, and 35% of the participants with Parkinson's said they found it difficult to have sex within the last month. Dr. Whitman, does that line up with your experience? Or because for me, that seems like a low number.
Well, I would say that it is a more prevalent situation than perhaps this slide suggests. And, you know, it just depends on how people really answer these questions and how comfortable they are answering this. I meet largely with support groups of people with Parkinson's. Those are always very, very, very well attended groups, suggesting that it's really quite a big problem for people. And that's why we think of it as a sort of a normal problem in Parkinson's.
Yeah, and I think the thing that catches people off guard here is sex within the last month, because a lot of us, me included, are thinking, have I had sex in the last year? So the last month just seems too aggressive.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and then 35% of the participants with Parkinson's says they take medication for sexual dysfunction, and we'll get into some of those medications and treatments throughout the day. And then aging, hormonal changes, and some medications also can lead to worsened sexual changes. Let's talk a little bit about some of the Parkinson's symptoms and effects that can change your relationship. Dr. Whitman, we'll start with you in talking about some of the motor symptoms. Can you walk us through some of the points on this slide?
Yes. When people start losing some control over how they move their bodies, not only is there sort of the physical difficulty of moving through a sexual situation, but it can really also affect confidence about accomplishing sort of the sexual motions that people feel that they can, you know, that they can proceed with. And in many cases, you know, in our research, we have found that sex tends to be very nonverbal for most people throughout their life. All of a sudden, there really needs to be more of a need to talk about what's going on and accommodate. So, you know, it can make intimacy difficult.
My wife and I have talked on the podcast about how, because I have stiffness and slowness and tremors, she's sometimes, because of my motor symptoms, she's afraid to touch me because she's not sure how it's going to affect me.
Yes, and that of course again sort of highlights the idea that it's so important to talk. It sounds like you guys talk, and people need to be able to feel comfortable because it interrupts the flow of arousal as well when there's a concern that the person with Parkinson's is uncomfortable or that they would be affected negatively.
And then, Dr. Vaughn, some of the facial masking and speech difficulties can impact how you show and share your affection. But there's also sleep changes. Can you talk about some of the sleep issues that people might have that can also impact intimacy and sex drive?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, in a time when someone didn't live with Parkinson's, there might have been traditional kind of times that they engaged in sexual activity with their partner. It might have been in the evening or at night. And as someone's living with Parkinson's, that might not actually be the best time for them anymore. And we'll kind of get into some of those strategies. And so thinking about kind of what is the best time of day when you're the most awake, alert, when your motor functions the best, is one thing to kind of keep in mind and kind of thinking about timing of engaging in kind of intimate activities. Same thing, some people may have more sleepiness during the day as well. And so kind of looking at kind of your patterns and what are the best kind of windows of time, you may have to kind of create an environment to promote kind of that intimate behavior, even if it's in a time of day that maybe wasn't traditionally when you and your partner were thinking about having sex. So maybe that's making the room darker and, kind of thinking about it, trying to get blackout curtains or having kind of the bedtime routine in place, even if it's in the middle of the afternoon, because that's maybe the better time for you.
Yeah.
For you.
Light some candles, put some aromatherapy around,
exactly.
make it your little romantic oasis. And planning, my wife and I, we met with a sex therapist, and she's like, listen, all your life, you've actually planned your sexual encounters. You made a date on Tuesday for Friday night. So you spent the whole week primming and prepping for that night, knowing that you're probably going to have sex. Well, we never wanted to think of it like we were planning when we were going to have sex. And now we just need to be more, open to ourselves and truthful to ourselves about, yeah, we need to plan this because spontaneity
exactly
doesn't
right.
really work.
Exactly. I think you're exactly right that even when we think about times, maybe when Parkinson's wasn't part of the mix, we really were kind of planning out those times, got into routines, and we just have to kind of readjust in the setting of Parkinson's. Exactly right.
And Dr. Whitman, the impact of Parkinson's on body image, can you talk about that a bit?
Yes. I think any time that we have any physical changes, that suddenly we have less control over our bodies, our sort of sense of ourselves and confidence in ourselves begins to erode, because we now can't predict how we're going to feel and function from moment to moment. And when it comes to making love, there are two issues. One is, how am I going to function myself, but also what kind of pleasure am I going to be able to provide to my partner? So there's just a lot of sort of concerns that sort of when Parkinson's affects the body, that begins to rise in importance. How confident do I feel that I can manage my body well, and how well can I be for my partner? So, obviously that's a very strong emotional impact. And once we start worrying and thinking about how we're going to do, again, it sort of takes away from the arousal. So there's got to be, a lot of reassurance that has to go on mutually, and willingness to be honest and open about what's going on. And I think that makes it much, much more manageable when there's, a person with Parkinson's can be reassured that their partner still feels loved by them, still feels attracted to them, still feels that they can have pleasure in the relationship. So in both direction, it's an issue, and reassurance plays a very, very strong part.
And Dr. Whitman, before we move on, can you help us define what we mean when we talk about sex? Like, what is the,
yeah.
Is it just intercourse, or is there more to it?
So I'm extremely thrilled that you asked me this question, because it really is a very, very broad area. So, you know, Parkinson's affects people from, you know, perhaps ages in their 40s and up, but a lot of older people are affected by it. And by the time that people get older, oftentimes they're very reliant on intercourse and think of intercourse as sex. In fact, sex is a lot of different things. Sex is sensual touch. Sex is masturbation. Sex is giving and getting oral sex. Sex is using vibrators for stimulation. There are all different kinds of ways that one can be sexually active if one's single with oneself or if one's partner with one's partner. I think what's very important for anyone with Parkinson's disease is to be open to expanding that repertoire. You know, we probably all had that repertoire when we were 16 and weren't allowed to have sex. So everybody kind of went in every direction they could. But as people get more, as people get partnered, their sex life can become a little bit more narrow and suddenly intercourse becomes the only thing. So it is not the only thing. So I'm really glad you asked me that question.
Great. We're going to move on to the next slide. And this is about sexual changes women have with Parkinson's. And I'm going to stick with you, Dr. Whitman, and then when we get to the men, I'll get to you, Dr. Vaughn. But if you have something to add here, feel free to chime in. So can you walk us through this side, Daniela?
Yeah. So let me say that when we talk about Parkinson's, we also have to factor into it that some of the women who are diagnosed with Parkinson's may already be menopausal or postmenopausal, which means that there will be a loss of estrogen in the body, which lowers libido and interest in sex, and which causes vaginal dryness, so they could be pain with intercourse. And there may be already some challenges to climax, although usually the stimulation of the clitoris can still be quite viable for orgasm. Now, with Parkinson's, when there is the decrease in dopamine, it has some of the same effects. There can be a loss of sex drive and then insufficient lubrication, inability to achieve climax. Some of that also depends on where the Parkinson's is affecting the nerves to see whether, there's vaginal lubrication and comfort with intercourse. So intercourse can become painful, and then it's very important to talk with one's gynecologist or one's neurologist about what are some of the remedies for that. And there are remedies. There are lubricants and moisturizers that can be used. Again, vibrators are very, very good for stimulating blood flow, particularly, for example, in the clitoral area that helps with sexual sensations. And even though some people tend to think of vibrators as some kind of strange, born, fake penises, they basically just stimulators of blood flow, which is very, very useful for producing sexual stimulation. So, yes, all the things that you see on the slide can happen. And it's important to recognize that these things can be remedied and discussed with one's doctor and systematically work towards improving them.
Well, you say it can be discussed with your doctor, and I know every time I go to the neurologist, they ask me on a questionnaire about my sex life, but then it's never discussed in the session. And is that my responsibility to bring it up to him, or should it's kind of an awkward thing to bring up? If you're embarrassed, how do you get your doctor to address it? Do you have some tips for folks?
Yes, I do. In fact, any support group that I've ever gone to, people always really want their doctor to start the conversation because they're not sure whether it should be part of their like neurological care, or they're just embarrassed. So it's ideally the doctor should bring it up, but we also know that often doctors don't, just as Larry's saying. So first of all, you have some tips on a sheet that's available sort of as a part of this podcast webinar. But I think it's important to recognize that this is a concern. Then I think perhaps sit down and think about what the concern is and write it down. I think sometimes it helps to leave a message for the doctor that you want to discuss sexual concerns ahead of time so that the doctor can, A, address your questions, but also in some cases inform himself or herself about the sexual side effects of Parkinson's and how to remedy them, or who are the specialists that the doctor can refer you to so that you can actually get the help that you need.
Right. I mean, they may refer you to a urologist to check you out, to see what kind of medication you may need.
Yes, they can send you to a urologist. The woman can be sent to a gynecologist. But remember that those conversations are not always easy in those offices either. So I think it requires persistence until you get the right person. And sometimes that person is a mental health provider with training in sexual health. In urology, there's a specialty, sexual medicine specialty, and those people are much more likely to have that conversation with you than just a general urologist.
We are getting some questions about if sex or masturbation can be helpful to Parkinson's disease by releasing extra dopamine. To either of you.
I don't think that we have any evidence necessarily of the kind of potential for it to help with this, you know, releasing dopamine, at least not in some sort of long-term way. I would say that sometimes for some of the lubrication issues that, you know, having more sex will help with kind of lubrication, at least from that's our experience with women. And I do think that, sexual health is a really important part of our overall health. And so I think regular sexual activity is an important part of overall well-being. And so regardless of whether it has a specific effect on the, you know, Parkinson's disease process itself, I think it's a really important part of overall health in general.
I really want to second that, if I may.
Sure.
I really want to second that because, you know, sort of classically when we talk about sexual function, we talk about the fact that a sexual stimulation gives rise to dopamine in the brain. I don't really know how it is different in the brain of a person with Parkinson's, but we all know that sexual stimulation, having orgasms, kind of adds to one's sense of well-being or can. So to the degree that it's pleasurable and that it's pleasant, it can't be anything but something positive.
Well, that's an important point, and I think that we can't stress that enough. And I'll ask you each to answer this. How important is it for people to have a healthy sex life?
I think that it's, you know, also driven by the individual and what their own goals are for their sex life. But I think for many people, it's, you know, just as important as your, you know, regular exercise routine and those healthy relationships in your life that help with stress management and your, you know, so I consider it a really important part, again, of someone's overall well-being, but the frequency of the activity might vary depending on the, you know, the individual's kind of goals for themselves and interests as well. And there certainly can be an aspect of, you know, of anything that's good in our life of also too much or, you know, kind of behaviors that can be troublesome for relationships. And so we should also kind of keep that in mind is how is, you know, one's sexual health impacting their overall relationships with other people too. So
what I quite agree with Dr. Wan. So I think everybody sort of has to look at their own situation and see what's available to have a healthy sex life. I think a healthy sex life for a single person can be just masturbation. A healthy sex life for somebody who's feeling already quite handicapped by Parkinson's can be infrequent but loving sexual contact and affection. You know, I think we have to think about definitions and what's available. So that's one part of it. But I want to tell you a story. Here in Michigan at Wayne State University, they responded to some research findings that sexual health, frequency of sexual activity or being sexually active was associated with better physical health. And they took it to nursing homes and they studied compared people who were sexually active with people who were not, and found that people who were sexually active had a much better sense of well-being, were less depressed. They couldn't really establish the physical health necessarily, but there was something about being sexually active that seemed to have a positive effect on much older people.
And I think one of the fun parts of a sexual relationship with somebody is the flirtation, the lead up to it, the intimacy, you know, a text from work or, a handwritten note in their lunch or, the sort of the build up to that event can also be exhilarating and fun.
100%. Totally agree.
Absolutely.
All right. So let's move on to some sexual changes with men. And Dr. Vaughn, I'm going to have you lead us through this conversation. We are getting a lot of questions around this, but why don't you go ahead and talk about what some of the sexual changes we can expect in men are, and then we've got some questions from the audience that we'll pepper you with.
Okay. So I think because of some of the, and again, while dopamine is the kind of the neurotransmitter that we focus on a lot in Parkinson's, because of the treatments that we have that often are focused on dopamine as well, there are various kind of parts of the nervous system that are involved in sexual performance that also are involved, maybe impacted in Parkinson's that are part of the dopamine system, but maybe part of other systems as well that, involve other, like the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system that lead to some of these effects that you're seeing on this slide. And so it is often kind of a multi kind of factorial condition. In addition to that, just the impact of Parkinson's, you may also have other medical conditions that the person is living with and other medications that a man may be on that can impact sexual function. And so just keep in mind that it's even if we're talking about some of the changes that we are connected to living with Parkinson's and the impact of Parkinson's on the body, that there's often several factors that are impacting sexual function, which gives us more opportunities, again, to look at different treatment options. So as in women, there may be decreased libido or sex drive in the setting of Parkinson's with the loss of dopamine. Now, some of the medications that are used for Parkinson's may actually kind of lead to some hypersexuality. So this can, but generally what we think of as being related to the disease process in Parkinson's leads to decreased libido. There may be some difficulty in attaining an erection or in maintaining an erection that's sufficient for intercourse. And so that's where we have several different treatment options that are available to help with erectile function in men, which gives us, again, some more drug therapy options in men that are not always available for women living with Parkinson's. In the setting of ejaculation, you could have experienced delayed ejaculation or too early. There are also some medications that are often used in the setting of prostate enlargement in men that may lead to something called retrograde ejaculation. And so if there are ejaculatory concerns, then those are also something to bring up with your doctor to see if there are medications, again, that might be impacting that as well.
What you were just talking about, that I just went to the urologist last month and for some incontinence issues, and they gave me Flomax, and they told me that would happen with Flomax, and that would be one of the side effects was the retrograde ejaculation.
Exactly. Yeah, and I will say that there's nothing really dangerous or problematic necessarily about not having ejaculation or having the retrograde ejaculation. It just may be a very different experience than what someone has experienced prior to that time, and so kind of letting them know to expect that. I think I'm glad to hear that you were warned about that ahead of time too.
Well, and what's interesting is with everything with Parkinson's, it's a new experience. So every day is a new experience. So why should this be any different?
Yeah. I think it's good to bring up things so that, people may not have associated with Parkinson's or realize that this is a potential, condition that occurs also, so that if, there are treatments available, those are being brought up to your healthcare team. And we often do have things that we can do to help.
Does levodopa cause erectile dysfunction?
So levodopa can impact, I will say, blood pressure. Some people who, as they're on increasing doses of levodopa, may experience more low blood pressure. And to the extent that, having low blood pressure and could impact the ability of the penis to, the veins in the penis to kind of engorge and fill, which is one of the important steps in leading to an erection. I think there's a, you know, that's a possibility. As far as levodopa itself causing other challenges, though, I think, you know, we don't commonly think of that as a main side effect of it. And to the extent that levodopa would help someone move better, it might be that those things would kind of balance each other out. And you know, the potential that you have better mobility, which could allow you to engage in activity more, you know, easily. I'd say that I would, in general, probably having levodopa on board is more helpful than potentially causing, you know, a side effect that would limit sexual activity. But certainly if you're experiencing a lot of low blood pressure with it, we want to bring that up.
Right. There is a question here about managing or minimizing tremor while getting anxious or excited, which, you know, can worsen the tremor with sex.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, if you know that a certain, I mean, you might think about what are the best times with, again, your medication effect from your, the medications that you're, you know, the dopaminergic medications, so whether that's levodopa or one of the dopamine agonists, you know, what's the, it's usually around 45 to 90 minutes for those medications to kind of have, you know, kind of peak effect. It, everyone's a little different. And so thinking about, again, the timing of intercourse or sexual activity, intimacy with best function or best on times with your medication dosing is probably really important. Exactly right. If there is excitement, anxiety, that does sometimes bring on more tremor activity. I might suggest that to maybe engage in sexual activity more frequently, and that may help with that over time. So I think, and then having that conversation with your partner about what you're experiencing as someone living with Parkinson's, and that let's move on forward through that as we can, are things to consider as well.
Yeah, and maybe that's not the day you have intercourse. Maybe that's another, that's a day where you do something different.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple comments here on how to date with Parkinson's and navigate sex with somebody new. I'll start with you, Dr. Vaughn, and then I'll give Dr. Whitman a chance to chime in as well, because I think this is an important topic.
Yeah, I think I saw a question kind of in preparing for the webinar also on this topic, kind of when to disclose. And I think, you know, that's certainly up to the individual. I would think I'll just say that if you're looking for long-term relationships, I think honesty is one of the biggest components of successful long-term relationships. And I would, I would think that disclosing Parkinson's would be something that would come up earlier in the relationship. Maybe not, you know, may not have to, obviously, on the first time you're meeting someone, if you don't feel like you kind of know yet where things are headed. But I think it would be something that would want to be, you know, there at, you know, earlier in the relationship development.
It probably also depends on your symptoms, your motor symptoms, especially if you're, you know, if you're getting dyskinesia every day, you probably need to explain why.
Why? Yeah. And I mean, I think it's, you know, it's part of someone's medical health. It's not like we're always telling everyone, you know, but I think in a relationship, I mean, even if you had a condition, maybe like high blood pressure, where medications for that condition can also impact sexual function. That might be something that in a relationship you would want to disclose at some point if you're going to engage intimately, so that someone knows what you're also living with. So, you know, I think it's, you know, it's not something that someone should feel like they have to share immediately, but I think it would want to be early on in the relationship.
Dr. Yeah, so, Whitman, any advice that you'd like to add?
Yes. What I would like to add is, I mean, I agree with everything that was said. What I would like to add is, you know how when we begin to date new people, we're kind of a little bit anxious to get started, to develop a relationship and so on. I think that anybody who's got any kind of a chronic condition has to really look at who they are dating and assess, you know, fairly early on whether you're dating somebody who is a thoughtful person, a person who is compassionate, a person who is interested in learning about you much more than just the attraction. Because I think when you decide to disclose, you're testing. You're testing the person, and you're testing whether they can hear the information, be interested in more, and you want that person, you want to keep on assessing at any time that you disclose anything. Like, for example, first you disclose that you have Parkinson's before you ever talk about the sexual issues, as a way of just testing where is this relationship going to be able to go. So I just would say, you know, definitely it's important to disclose and be part of the conversation and part of the relationship in its fullness, but also just keep on assessing the capacity of the person that you're engaging with.
If you're enjoying this podcast, share it with a friend or rate and review it on iTunes. It helps listeners like you find and support our mission. MichaelJFox.org. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the podcast.
We're going to move on to medications that can impact sex life, and then we'll get into some treatments. I'm going to start, though, with a question we'll start with Dr. Vaughn. Can cannabis impact your sexual libido positively or negative?
I would say generally we think of cannabis as being more of a depressant for most activities that involve kind of, you know, particularly neurologic function. And so it does not generally enhance sexual function from kind of that, you know, that perspective. And so I'm not generally recommending cannabis use. I know there's a lot of interest in kind of CBD oil and these other things, but we don't generally recommend cannabis use and, you know, kind of in general for people living with Parkinson's, and then not for sexual function.
Great. Dr. Whitman, do you see sexual changes more commonly in the early onset PD or the older people with PD?
So I think that there's more of an awareness of changes in the younger people because the change is sort of more dramatically impacts what they are used to doing. And younger people have probably more frequent sexual activity. So there is definitely an awareness that things are changing. There are a lot of emotions about what is changing, in a sense that people, as they are older and may have somewhat lower sex drive and less sexual activity, that it's sort of less impactful. That's at least been my experience.
Every time I go to the neurologist, they ask me if I've been shopping excessively on the internet. They ask me if I have been hypersexual. They ask me if I've been gambling. And oftentimes it's because, it can be related to some of the medications you take that
right,
can cause those behaviors.
Right.
Yeah, dopamine agonists are among those that have caused hypersexuality. Can you talk a bit about how that is and then what you can do if you find yourself in that situation, Dr. Whitman?
Yes. So sort of the research says that there is a possibility of having hypersexual behavior as a result of being on the dopamine agonists. Maybe gambling, other kinds of things that look to other people as kind of addictive behaviors. They can cause disruption in relationships and serious concerns. It's been my discussion with a neurologist that they will change the dose of the medication to improve that. There can also be some behavioral interventions, but my experience has been more that it has been a matter of changing the dosage of the medication to kind of relieve that kind of activity. I think sometimes it comes on slowly and it's very distressing, and it's very important to discuss it to be able to address it as soon as possible.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dr. Whitman, I've talked to several people who have experienced this, and they actually say it's fairly euphoric. They feel invincible, and they don't realize that it's happening. They don't feel the pains of Parkinson's anymore, and they feel like they are on top of the world when they're in this state. So it's almost something that needs to be monitored by the care partner.
It's the partners who see it. Yes, absolutely. It's the partners who have to address it, and they have to address it with a physician because the person who's experiencing that euphoria is not, you know, not necessarily going to reflect on it themselves.
And let's talk a little bit about the care partner. The care partner themselves can also be exhausted and depressed and have a lack of sex drive. Dr. Vaughn, what advice do you have for these care partners that are trying to balance the, you know, being a wife or a girlfriend or a husband or a spouse and also a care partner? Like, how do you balance that? How do you get over the exhaustion? How do you begin to look at who you're taking care of as sexy again? Like, it's hard.
Right. I don't want to, you know, minimize it to say it's something that could be simply kind of answered, but to say that, again, you know, that relationship is built on many things beyond, you know, what is now occurring with Parkinson's. And so, again, to the extent that we're talking about kind of scheduling sexual activity, intimacy times, taking yourself out of the typical routines, or if possible, even the environment that you're in on a daily basis, if it's feasible to, you know, have a getaway weekend, a staycation somewhere at maybe a hotel in town, even not necessary, but that's just a way of kind of getting yourself out of your usual routine or environment. Maybe using favorite song, you know, music that you share together in your relationship, looking at remembering memories of romantic times. You talked about candles and, you know, whatever those things are that you have shared as a couple over the years that bring out the kind of romance, and take, and really then think about, again, the timing. You know, maybe the best time for both of you is at 10 a.m., you know, or 1 p.m. or something that's maybe, again, a really non-traditional time for your relationship, for those types of activities earlier in your life together. And, you know, try to kind of create that environment in a very intentional way, and give both of you, you know, more time to get in the mood and, you know, doing some of those things that aren't maybe the intercourse activities, to try to, you know, bring on that, the kind of arousal that was talked about, because it may take a little more effort than it has in previous, you know, years of life.
And if the person with Parkinson's is going through depression or apathy, they may be on some medication that could also lower their sex drive.
It is possible. And so, one of the, things that could be a way of entering into kind of conversations with a physician or nurse practitioner, or APP that's caring for you, could be anytime a new medication is being prescribed, or maybe prescriptions are even being renewed. If sexual dysfunction is one of the things that's been troubling, is to maybe ask at that time, even, you know, how will this medication change, or new medication, will it have any impact on my sex life or sexual function, as a way of kind of opening the door to that conversation too. I mean, I think, again, with any medication, there are obvious benefits and potential risks, or we hope there are obvious benefits and there's usually potential risks. And so, even with depression medications, many of them may have some effect on libido, but certainly, you know, not treating depression is not a good idea in the life of anyone, but especially in those folks living with Parkinson's disease. So
right.
I think we have to kind of balance that, obviously. So.
Oh, go ahead, Dr. Whitman.
I just wanted to mention that, you know, there are some medications that have greater and lesser sexual side effects. And so speaking to a knowledgeable provider, that can be sort of sorted out, whether the medications that do not have sexual side effects can be useful for treating the depression in the person with Parkinson's. That's one thing that can be done. One of the things that antidepressants do is they have an effect on orgasm. They make it harder to come to orgasm. And it's very important for people to know that. And there have been times where, between the provider and the patient, they have discussions about taking a vacation from an antidepressant for a day to be able to experience sexual pleasure more intensely. This is not something anybody should be doing on their own. It's only really in discussion with their physician. But this is something that definitely can be managed. And again, it's very important to balance, as was said before, the importance of managing depression versus, you know, optimal sexual function, because anybody who's not going to be taking antidepressant medication is probably going to be depressed, and that in itself interferes with sexual function. So it's important to treat the depression.
Dr. Vaughn, are there any interactions between the PD medications and erectile dysfunction medications like Cialis or Viagra?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I mentioned a little earlier that particularly levodopa, but the dopamine agonist as well may lower blood pressure. And one of the more common side effects of the medications for erectile dysfunction, like, you know, sildenafil or Viagra or tardenafil or Cialis or any of them really, is that they can also lower blood pressure. So I think we have to be just thoughtful about looking at kind of how blood pressure control is going for the individual, and be, you know, again, looking at overall medications that are being used. For instance, if someone's also on the drug you mentioned earlier, tamsulosin, which also can lower blood pressure, we often are telling our men who are taking that to maybe not take it on the day, the tamsulosin, on the day that they're going to use medication for erectile dysfunction like sildenafil, for instance. That's not something that we really can do as easily with the Parkinson's medications usually. And so it might be looking at dose adjustments, at least if low blood pressure is part of the some of the conditions that someone's living with, to make sure it's safe to use the medications for erectile dysfunction if they're needed. Or there are some other potential strategies to help with erectile dysfunction that might not involve those medicines if low blood pressure. But I'd say that's the main concern. It's not so much interacting with how the you know, medications like levodopa work for Parkinson's. It's looking at that blood pressure issue that can sometimes come up.
And can they lose their efficacy over time if you use Viagra or Cialis over the course of time? Does it lose its power?
I don't think the medication loses its potency necessarily, but I mean, I certainly had patients who said, you know, that worked for me for a while and then didn't seem to work as well. And again, I think it's reasonable to look at a multifactorial assessment and see if there's other things that have changed in that intervening time that we could modify to try to help. It may be that the disease has progressed and the impact on the nervous system that's you know, responsible for kind of erectile function or orgasm, you know, is also being impacted more. And so I think, you know, it's somewhat common in my practice, at least, to have people, you know, come back maybe a few years later and say, okay, now what, you know, what's the next step, because they've had some where it hasn't worked as well. I also remind people though that, you know, even the medications for erectile dysfunction, they don't, you know, there's some of the, like the injection form, which most men don't want to do, which I don't blame them at all, is maybe the only one that produces an erection. But even the medications, the pill-based versions, they create the kind of environment to have an erection. They don't cause an erection. So you still have to have stimulation and arousal and those other, you know, important pieces to the activity to have kind of an erection occur. So, and there are windows of time that the drugs work. So I tend to find I have better success with some of my patients with sildenafil, which is Viagra, but it only works for about 4 hours. So you have to, again, be thinking about your window of time for activity. you know, you've got about 4 hours. So it does, you know, that scheduling activity really comes into play. Yeah.
Sometimes it's useful to try Cialis, which has a longer term effect. But the other thing that some men have used quite successfully has been vacuum devices, which are non-medical treatments for erectile dysfunction, which can be quite helpful in creating an erection, you know, pumping blood from the body into the penis, using a ring to trap the blood, and then, you know, minus 45 minutes to be engaged in sexual activity. So that's another option.
I just want to say, I work for the Veterans Health Administration as well, and they will actually provide vacuum erection devices for people that receive their health care there. So
that's good to know. Should everybody, you know, that's having these types of issues seek out some sex therapy? I mean, you know, as you go along, we have physical therapy, we have, you know, other types of therapy. What's, you know, we've listed several here online, but is that something that you should bring into your care team?
Well, personally, I think that it's very useful. If sex is important to you, then it's important to have somebody who will be your educator, your advocate, and your just information provider. And sex therapists who are familiar with Parkinson's can be very helpful as collaborators with your physicians. It doesn't mean that you're in therapy every week. It just means that you may need to go in to sort of evaluate where you are, what are some of the methods that are going to improve your sexual pleasure and also your sexual relationship in this new setting. And that can be, you know, once in a while visit. I mean, there are people who have relationship issues that would benefit from sex therapy. But I think just having somebody who understands that sex is important, who's familiar with sexuality and the impact that chronic conditions can have on it, I think can be very, very useful. They're not that available. I mean, there is a website, AASECT, I can provide it later, .org, which lets you know the location of every certified sex therapist in every state in the United States.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Yeah, we'll pass that along. We'll put that in the resources list. And then we've talked about some of the pills you can take and the topical therapies. We've mentioned injections and lubricants, vacuum devices and vibrators. What's the surgery that you would have?
So there is a penile implant that can be done by a urologist to provide kind of a mechanical way to create an erection. And so that's certainly an option and is something that a urologist would typically be the person to consult with, the type of doctor to consult with about that option.
There are a couple of different types of those devices. Some of them require a fair bit of manual dexterity, so they may not be the best implants to use, and some are just simply bendable implants. Again, this is a pretty major intervention and surgery, so it would have to be very much in the context of understanding the importance of sexuality, the importance of intercourse, and sort of the desire to have that capacity.
And I want to loop back down to a topic we've already discussed a little bit, but I want to go into more detail. There's a lot of people, both men and women, who are chiming in on the webinar who are bringing up the inability to achieve orgasm. And if you have some advice for them on how they can solve that issue.
So the main thing to do is to try to be sexually active when very well rested. Fatigue can really influence the ability to have an orgasm, so that would be the first thing to be aware of. The other would be if manual stimulation or intercourse doesn't do the job, then definitely vibrators can be useful, using plenty of lubricant, and allowing oneself slowly and gradually move in that direction, trying to be relaxed, create and kind of an erotically stimulating situation. But I would say vibrators are excellent. There is for women, there is a clitoral pump that also exists. If you look on the internet, it's called Eros. And that brings blood into the clitoris, and that can help with stimulation to bring to orgasm. Last thing I want to mention is that, you know, men can use vibrators too, not just women, to stimulate their scrotum, to stimulate their penis, to just be playful, take time, but definitely be rested.
So you talk about this in such a casual way, Dr. Whitman, and for a lot of people, this is very new ground, and it can be they can be fearful of it, they can be embarrassed by it. How do you discreetly go about obtaining a vibrator?
You can go to an internet location called goodvibes.com. That's a pretty bona fide place to look at their products, and then they will mail them to you.
And the mail carrier is not going to go, here's your vibrator. It's going to be in a discreet packaging, right?
There's not a picture of it on the packaging, no.
Well, I mean, if you've never ordered it before, it may be intimidating. The same thing with vacuum devices.
I will say something about that, and that is if you travel with a vibrator or with a vacuum pump, just put it in your luggage that you check through so that they don't open your luggage and then you have to explain why you have those things, you know, when you go through TSA.
That is a great tip. That's terrific. And then we have some other questions here that we're just going to run through as we have our final 8 minutes of the webinar here. What are somebody's asking about testosterone supplements. Are they helpful in this situation?
So I'll just say that there have been several studies that have come out in the last few years that National Institutes of Health funded looking at testosterone in older men, not necessarily in men with Parkinson's. So these are kind of looking at men as they get older specifically. I will tell you, they had about 700 men enrolled in these studies. They had to screen 50,000 to find the 700 that qualified based on a lot of different exclusion criteria for the studies that tried to rule out, you know, men with any cardiovascular disease were excluded, or obstructive sleep apnea, or of course, any history of genital urinary cancer or anything. So I just want to, we see a fair number of men sometimes being placed on testosterone, and there are potentially some benefits for specific symptoms. Certainly, if they have very low testosterone, it may help with sexual function. It may help with some fatigue, but largely, it's a very small, kind of percentage of men, even in the general population, that are going to benefit from testosterone therapy. The other is to really diagnose low testosterone. It needs to be measured at the same time, like 3 days in a row at an early morning testing time when the blood sample is taken, because testosterone levels vary in an individual throughout the day. And so if you're measuring it at different times, you may get, incorrect information. So that's all just to say that, I'd be curious about your input, Dr. Whitman, but I just find very few men where it really probably is useful because of
I quite agree. I quite agree. And the critical point that you just made was, it's not really based on the sexual symptoms. It's based on low testosterone. So a man who's got erectile dysfunction or low libido, but has normal testosterone, that would not be a situation where anybody would supplement it. It would have to be associated also with low testosterone, and it really is a plus minus experience for men. So I think that it's, it always seems like such an attractive solution, but I think it's not quite as successful as we all wish it would be.
Let's go through some rapid fire questions here so we get as many in as possible. DBS, does DBS surgery, as people are contemplating that or have had that, does that have an impact on sexual changes?
Yeah, right. Deep brain stimulation. So I'm not aware that it negatively impacts sexual function. And again, as it may very much help motor function in particular, and potentially lower the need for some of the other medications some of the dopamine medications. Probably, again, if it does have any kind of impact on sexual function, those types of benefits would outweigh that.
Great. Dr. Whitman, one for you. People trying to navigate sex and relationships with people who are having people with Parkinson's who have cognitive decline or dementia. What's the advice there?
So that really does come up in discussions. And I think that it causes a great deal of pain for the partner because they may begin to feel that the person that is wanting sexual activity with them is no longer the person that they knew for all these years, because now this is becoming more instinctual and less oriented towards them as a partner where they have a history of sexual intimacy. So I think sometimes partners feel guilty and uncomfortable about either limiting or discontinuing sexual activity. And I think that it's important for the partners to examine their own feelings about it and proceed accordingly. I think that, you know, physical contact and sexual activity is always pleasurable and sweet, but I think that if there is no longer mutuality, I think it's legitimate for the partner to question how much they want to be involved.
Okay, Dr. Vaughn, how do you know the difference between hypersexuality and a strong libido?
Well, I would say that the hypersexuality is when the behaviors are starting to disrupt other relationships. And so if the care partner is starting to complain, or if the interest is leading to destructive behaviors that are impacting other relationships because of sexual addiction or, you know, staying up all night looking at websites with pornography or that kind of thing, then that's when I would classify it as a, you know, something that's more of a concern that we should try to intervene upon.
Okay. And then also, real quick, ultrasound wave therapy for erectile dysfunction. What do you know about that?
That is a new one for me, and I will look it up, but maybe Dr. Whitman has experience.
I think that this is very much in the experimental phase. I would not recommend that anybody undergo this unless it's in a randomized controlled trial that somebody legitimate is undertaking. It's not a treatment option at this time.
All right. Well, I want to wrap this up real quickly with some tips. Again, we want everybody to be open and honest with their partners. Yes.
On the earlier questions, any advice for the LGBT community?
Oh, yes, that's important.
Yeah, I just really wanted to speak to that because I think that in healthcare, LGBT community folks feel very kind of marginalized and not responded to because nobody addresses specifically their needs. It's very important for people with Parkinson's who are gay or lesbian, bisexual, or transgender to build community. And I think that support systems for people with Parkinson's, just like this foundation or other organizations, can help people connect so that people can build community, support each other, and learn to understand their specific challenges.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Whitman, Dr. Vaughn. Thank you so much for your expertise.
Thank you for inviting
us. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you all for attending. I hope you have a great day, and thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. Community members like you are bringing us closer than ever to a world without Parkinson's disease. Learn how you can support the Michael J. Fox Foundation in its mission at michaeljfox.org.
This is Michael J. Fox. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Learn more about the Michael J. Fox Foundation's work and how you can help speed a cure at michaeljfox.org.